Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 102 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling WSU's Randy Fortenberry Paints a Troubling Economic Picture in Hopeful Colors 2, about a presentation the agricultural economist gave at the WSCIA annual meeting on November 12, 2018. For those who may not know their acronyms, WSCIA stands for Washington State Crop Improvement Association. Their annual meeting in Moscow, Idaho this year included lots of wheat seed growers and representatives of regional agribusinesses associated with the industry, as well as firms with national and international footprints. That was Fortenberry's audience, and me, of course. There's not much I do in terms of producing a Fortenberry podcast. His presentations are well organized, his speech is concise, and his diction is clear. And like all really good economists, he can be kind of funny. In the second part of Fortenberry's presentation at the WSCIA, he picks apart U.S. Department of Agriculture numbers, explains why U.S. market share matters, and describes global trade flows that operate on an action-reaction dynamic that's not always understood. Please remember, when I posted the first half of Fortenberry's presentation last week, I added many of the slides he used to the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. You don't need them to understand his presentation, but they do add a visual element. The second half begins with Fortenberry discussing WASDE forecast. WASDE stands for World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. And Fortenberry here is talking about an outlook that looks at wheat prices and supplies into the future.
USDA every February puts out these 10-year forecasts. They're wrong as hell because they're going out 10 years. But what they are is a pretty good lower bound estimate. Because here's what they, in terms of price, because what they do is they assume everybody has a good production season. That's how they come up with the world production number, right? And then the ending stocks is, demand stays relatively stable, except it grows with population growth. Okay, so that's how they come up with those. But both those things are increasing. World production goes up, world ending stocks go up. The larger ending stocks are, the more negative that is for price, because that's the excess supply that can cover the market if somebody has a production problem before the price has to really rally to reflect new scarcity. So you really, that's not really a price positive situation. And you'll notice they did account for the decline this year. Right? There's a little bit of a downtick right there. So that's their forecast. The reason I say it's an important benchmark, though, is because we're assuming perfect production conditions and everybody's producing wheat and harvesting wheat, that means the price implications, we should look at that as sort of the lower bound price. That's the worst price we should see. It's a possibility, but if anything goes wrong, we can get a higher price. So whenever you see that price in the market, you don't really need to get too aggressive to sell because there's not a lot of downside price risk left. But if you're well above that at some point, that might be a sales opportunity because if you come back to this long run average, everybody has a good year next year, we'll drop back down to sort of this projection. Here's their export forecast for 10 years. It shows, so the yellow is the EU. EU becomes the largest exporter. And they're growing significantly. This blue line is Russia. Number two, growing significantly. Now, this assumes they don't have a production problem in any of these years. Okay, look at the U.S. We're this dark blue one. We're pretty big, but we go flat. So total world exports are going up, and ours stays flat. What's that mean? Our market share is going to go down. This was all calculated and estimated last February before any of the trade issues. So without any trade disruption, USDA was already projecting our export share of world trade was going to decline over the next 10 years, and here's what it looks like. It goes from a little over 15.5% 2 years ago to about 13% 8 years from now. That's not price positive in your own market for two reasons. One, you're not selling as much, but the second one is this. The smaller your market share of the market, the less a problem with you affects the market price. Okay? If we had a complete drought and we were 2% of the export market, the world price would never change. And because wheat is a global commodity, our price wouldn't change much either. Our basis might get stronger. Our cash price relative to futures might go up a little bit. But the whole price surface wouldn't rise. So as we decline our market export share, we already are going to have less influence on world prices, thus our domestic price, based on our own local supply-demand environment. If we disrupt that because trade isn't allowed to happen, or we restrict trade below this 13% market share, then that's even more dramatic in terms of the lack of a price effect when we have a problem here, a drought, or even an unexpected increase in demand, a transportation issue, a strike on the rail line. Anything that disrupts trade can have a small local effect, but it'll be capped by the world price, and the world price won't respond as dramatically to our problem as it would if we had a larger market share going forward. So already as I look out 10 years, I'm a little concerned about where our position will be, and that's without considering true trade disruptions. And like I said before, one of the problems is if you lose market share in the short run because you have a trade disagreement, you don't necessarily get that back in the long run just because you go back to your original pricing environment because you've already given up your supply to somebody else who can also satisfy the demand in that foreign country. Here's the U.S. wheat price that USDA looks at going out 10 years. Now, this is the one that should be looked at as a lower bound estimate. It's a very pessimistic price because it assumes everybody has good production. It assumes that we do lose 2 percentage points on our market export share. And it assumes that the growth in demand really only comes from population growth. We don't find new uses for wheat or something else that happens that increases demand for everybody. In other words, everybody's willing to buy more at the given price, not just the new people that show up in the market. But you can see that 510 is kind of their long-run average, which is also what they're predicting now. So if I look at that, and I look at who's got a lot of wheat, this is what was brought into this marketing year. Here's China. China doesn't have to buy wheat anyway, or coarse grain. So when people are talking about Russia running out of exports or China needing to buy soybeans, they have huge stocks of everything. They can sit for a while without being aggressive buyers before they have to come back to the market. They might be able to wait longer than we can as a supplier to the market. But look how much Russia brought in last year that could be sold that's added to their lower production this year. Here's other countries altogether. Here's the European Union. They're down a little bit. Canada was down. But most of the exporters brought more in last year than they did the year before. So even with a reduction in their production this year, it's not like they're out of wheat. And they can't satisfy the demand that we're not filling right now. U.S. price responds aggressively to those world carryout numbers. How much is left over at the end of the year helps predict what the market price is going to be in the coming year. And this has been the relationship. So this is world carryout. When it's high, our price is low. When it's low, our price is high. The problem with losing market share, though, is this relationship gets weaker. Okay, a lower world carryout doesn't translate into as high a U.S. price if you're a smaller part of the overall market to begin with. So that's a challenge we might face going forward. Not only has the Chinese currency gotten more valuable relative to the dollar, but the dollar itself has gotten more valuable relative to most exporters and importers that we sell to or compete with. This is the dollar index. It's the U.S. dollar tied to 6 major currencies. Some of them are buyers of ours. The Japanese yen is in there. Some of them compete with us. The euro is in there. As this goes up, the dollar is becoming less attractive, more attractive as an investment vehicle, but buying dollar goods as an international customer is becoming less attractive. So it makes imports to us cheaper, but it makes exports more expensive. And what our current trade policy is supposed to be doing is making imports to us more expensive for those critical commodities that we don't think we want to have a large import share of because of national security issues. So the dollar is working against the trade program right now anyway, which might help explain why U.S. steel prices are down. Maybe if the dollar never changed, we wouldn't have seen the decline in U.S. steel prices. But again, economies are complicated, and this laser beam approach to policy often can get disrupted if something outside of that policy instrument offsets the benefit that you think you're generating from the policy. So let's look at December futures prices for soft red wheat. I use soft red wheat because we tend to use that as the proxy for white wheat prices in the Pacific Northwest. Here we were last August. Nothing got sold because the market was going to go up forever. Here we were in September. But here's what I want to show you. So this is a big day today. I don't remember how much we were up, but it was a good day. But we've had other good days. And what I want to caution you against is seeing one or two days in a row like that and assuming we've set a new trend and that you shouldn't be selling wheat from last summer. Because I really think this trading range, we're going to be bound there for at least two or three more months. We need to get through the corn harvest, okay? So maybe we have corn problems. People are talking about it. But between October, November, December, the corn price has a lot to do with the U.S. wheat price. I don't see us going up here in the short run. Now, that doesn't mean something might not happen. Maybe I'll be completely wrong. But this is higher than the current USDA range. Okay, the USDA price tends to be below the futures for soft red at the end of the year. So that's probably a sales opportunity. This is $5.20. Here's December 2019. It's $5.68. So we're already saying next year should be better, significantly better. But this one I'm not willing to sell into yet because look what happened to December 2018 price at this time last year. There were several big rallies that happened for various reasons. Okay? So what does that mean? Here's that 510 USDA mid price. Here's what I think the local price is right now, at least based on the DTN report, about $6.36. That's way above USDA's price. Here's our spread in Washington over the USDA price over the last several years. That's much bigger than the spread. Here's about where this price should end up on average if this price ends up being right. And remember, most of the time, the final price is in that USDA November range. And this is what we're looking at right now. Doesn't mean that tomorrow, in fact, I'll guarantee you this, if you call Randy or somebody and sell for this today, if he's paying you that, it will be $7 tomorrow. But if you don't, it'll be $5 tomorrow. So it is a bit of a paradox. But I do think that's a lot to give up, given these projections. And the thing is, even if you don't believe USDA's price forecast is right, I really think over the next 3 or 4 months, this trade problem is a problem. If the House of Representatives does not support USCMA, and the president really does pull us out of NAFTA, that's going to be very negative for wheat prices at least through the remainder of this marketing year. Now, things may change later, but that's a lot of risk for the next 3 or 4 months to hope that everybody here is wrong and prices are going to be significantly higher than they already are. So here's my conclusions. This year's better than last year already, and I think next year will be better as well, but it's going to be better by dimes, not dollars, unless we have a huge production fall somewhere else. I'm not talking about what we currently see in Australia and Russia, because the market's priced a lot of that in, I think. Something beyond that. USDA is only talking about a 3% decline in global production, but that doesn't mean that's price positive for us if our market share of world trade goes down significantly. And so far, that's the situation that we're actually facing. The long-term projection of reduced export prices is troubling. And that's why I would sell now for anything I have left unpriced. But I would give the trade situation time to work through whatever dynamics it has before I start pricing next year's crop. USDA's compensation isn't going to cover the damage, but maybe it's better than nothing. I think we will probably see the second half of the payment, so we might spend the whole $12 billion if things don't improve over the next 3 or 4 months. But you're talking about 14 cents on a $5.10, or in our case, $6.36 price. It's not going to make the difference between everything being good and everything being bad. If you think about wheat in average, it's $119 million on a crop that's worth about $16 billion. So the trade compensation is quite small relative to the total value of the crop. And really, the biggest thing to watch over the next 6 or 8 weeks is those weekly export numbers. Are we starting to improve so that that USDA estimate over a billion bushels becomes possible, or do we continue to stay flat? Because if we do that through the next couple of months, then I see a lot of room for downward pressure in the January and February period. If exports don't improve significantly, it's going to be hard for me to see how prices can improve very far from where they are now.
Fortenberry took questions at this point. My question began with a statement. In a trade war, there are winners and losers. Who is going to be a loser in a trade war with China?
Well, I'm not sure it's quite a war yet, but it's approaching that possibly. It's a skirmish. I don't know. In fact, so I will tell you this. I don't know how many of you remember the name Howard Paulson, but Howard Paulson was George W. Bush's Secretary of Treasury. He also happened to be a Goldman Sachs executive before that, and in fact, Mnuchin worked for him. So have worked together a lot. In the 90s, he actually went to China to try to open up trade and investment. What he was really looking at was joint ventures. How can he get the Communist Party to back out of ownership of some Chinese firms with Western investment and then come the other direction too, Chinese investment into U.S. businesses? But he said just this week, he said, people misunderstood what I was telling them because I wasn't ever saying you get the Communist Party out and it won't be a command, control and command type economy. I was just trying to say we're better off working with them than trying to work against them, okay? He claims that there may not be a winner in this skirmish because he said we both grossly underestimated the other person's position. As an example, he says that going into the election, China assumed if they really targeted exports, they would hit at President Trump's base because it's largely rural. And if everybody's export opportunities suddenly dried up, they would turn on him. Well, that didn't happen. The Republicans picked up 3 Senate seats. Okay, they lost 3 seats in Iowa in the House, but most of the House turnover wasn't from rural America. It was suburban America. So they grossly underestimated the staying power of a large part of his base, even when they were facing some economic costs in the short run to the particular policy. Paulson also claims that we've grossly overestimated what it will take for China to give in and cave. One of the things is they have huge stocks, so they can wait a while. The other thing he's really worried about is, and this is where you get a lose-lose, if we suddenly have a drop in what he called the trade iron curtain, so China and we go separate ways, we don't do any business with each other, we try to control our parts of the world, because of the political instability in the South China Sea, he claims we lose Asia. So South Korea, Japan, places we thought were going to be growth opportunities like Vietnam and Indonesia, they're not going to take a position against China in a real trade war that they think may put them at political or military risk in the South China Sea. So he would actually argue there might not be any winners to this particular skirmish. But the trade thing, even though I talked about China, is much bigger than that. We have the most aggressive trade realignment that we're trying to invoke since the 1920s because we are renegotiating with everybody. The NAFTA situation, the EU, Turkey. If we do the one-on-one with Japan, we're trying to renegotiate everything at the same time across the broadest basket of traded goods that we've looked at since the 1920s. So it's very hard to say who the winners and losers will be because it'll be partly about staying power. How long can somebody maintain their position before they give in? It'll be about what you're able to actually negotiate, but it'll also be how your other trading partners respond to that situation. And so what I do think's happened so far here, we were supposed to have winners in our steel and aluminum industry, and it may still happen given enough time. The administration will tell you it just takes time. We're not there yet. All I'm saying is in the short run, that hasn't happened. We have to figure out how to compensate for exchange rates. One of the things we did with Turkey, by the way, we opposed tariffs on Turkey steel coming in too. Turkey's one of our top. You know, China's only our number 10 supplier. They supply less than 3% of steel. So to impose it on them really isn't doing anything effective in terms of the steel industry. But the Turkish, they're in all kinds of economic turmoil. Their currency has collapsed. So as the value of their currency was going down, their steel could still be imported cheaply because the dollar was so strong. So we doubled their tariff to 50% to try to offset the currency situation, even though it's not like they were manipulating the currency to make that happen. So it just becomes complicated figuring out what the next policy step is, and then who wins and loses from that is less than certain in my mind.
Another questioner wanted to know Fortenberry's thoughts on Brexit, Britain's divorce from the European Union, and how the U.S. could negotiate a trade deal with Europe with that hanging over everything.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because here's the problem. We're also talking about trying to do an EU trade deal. Until they figure out Brexit, there's nothing for us to negotiate with them. That's a real disaster. And that's a place we might win where suddenly the EU is not exporting wheat. They're a big wheat exporter, can be. If they have a serious implosion, either because they can't negotiate an easy way out or the market doesn't like what the terms are and their currencies respond to that and investment opportunities, then that might be a place where we lose competition in the wheat market, for example, because they're just not able to actually maintain their presence in the international market. That won't be a priority. But until Brexit is resolved, I don't see how we do any kind of trade negotiation with anybody, the EU or any individual country there either. That's a real challenge.
Finally, a questioner asked whether Fortenberry had any insight on the current farm bill debate.
No insight. So this is also a big issue, right? As you know, NOG has been lobbying to, hey, let's get this passed in the lame duck session. I don't see that happening because this is not McConnell's priority for just the last few weeks they have before they go into winter recess. So here's the real issue. This could be a positive or a negative. That's why I don't know which way this will go. If you think about the current farm bill stalemate, it's because the House has a very aggressive position on SNAP, the work rules around SNAP, that the Senate won't buy off on yet. And so a lot of the negotiation between the two senators and the two House members that are negotiating that has been a stalemate over that issue. They have to come to terms before it can come to the floor, and then both houses would have to give time on the floor for negotiation and passage. Right now, under the current Senate rules, they would need 60 senators to pass the thing. So that's why I don't think McConnell wants to do anything that requires a supermajority right now because it's likely to fail. Okay, so let's go into January. Now we have a completely new House who's likely to have much more liberal SNAP rules than the Senate. So we could just flip sort of what has to be negotiated. But also there's going to be change in the committee. So probably Peterson takes over as the House Ag Committee, and Conaway may stay as the minority lead, which is good because they have a great working relationship, by the way. But in the Senate, Stabenow said she might want to get off that committee completely and go somewhere else. So now we have a whole new player to come out of committee before we can even bring it to the floor. So I don't know if that's positive or negative. Maybe with the new House, the SNAP stuff goes away and everything else is agreed to and it gets passed. Maybe the new House decides, here's a chance to poke the president in the eye with his first failure under our leadership, and so they won't agree to anything. I have no idea which way that might go, or what happens if the Senate changes committee leadership.
Lots of unknowns in farming's future, but every unknown gets resolved eventually. I'll be watching the farm bill debate closely. Will there or won't there be a farm bill extension? Please join me again next week for episode 103 of Wheat All About It, an interview with the CEO of the Washington Grain Commission, Glenn Squires, right here on Wheat All About It.
We love the land, the farm's our career, but make no mistake, we do not steer. Mother Nature's in the driver's seat. I'm talking life and I'm talking wheat. We're riding shotgun, we have our say, but Mama Green, she shows the way. We feed you.